welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast. This is a podcast that focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations and work to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, a systemic team coach, a facilitator, and also a trainer. I am also the CEO of JC & Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with all their stakeholders. This episode is the second part of my interview with Professor Marc Durand, who is Professor of Organizational Ethnography at Cambridge Judge Business School, Cambridge University. Here, Marc and I explore the role that conflict plays in organizations and teams, from a fear of loss of identity to being a positive force in relation to idea generation and problem solving. I learnt a lot here about an underperforming rowing team that Marc will tell us more about. We also discuss how conflict is part of organizational culture and not something outside it, and how also conflict could be interpreted as a form of communication. Marc shares with me his six-step approach to having courageous conversations in lockdown and how we must not be deterred from working with conflict when we're all cocooned in a Zoom work environment. An important conclusion is the ability to create an environment that places empathy at the center. Here we agreed that leaders need to think anthropologically in order to achieve this. You can also find out where Marc will take his anthropological notebook. And also I'll put all Marc's links to his talks and publications that we discuss in the show notes. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. One thing that kind of also we've got the ethnography, we've got our interest in organizational culture where we cross over. But you know, when I first got to know your work, and then I realized that you also trained in organizational conflict resolution and mediation, and so am I. And which was, I guess, there's that kind of synergy with the ethnographic mindset as well, how we kind of synthesize different kind of narratives that are being and performances that are being played. But kind of broadly speaking, if we're thinking about organizational conflict, are there key types of conflict, do you think, that exist within organizations?
Yeah, so I do, right? I think one way of looking at conflict, and I'd be interested in your view as well, actually, because you're right. There are a lot of parallels between your training and my own, as well as our interests. But one way of looking at it would be to say, well, there's some internal drivers of conflict and maybe some external drivers, right? So the internal drivers are typically personality clashes, you know, just not kindred spirits. And sometimes it happens, right? Or it might be that there's some ambiguity around who's responsible for what. So there's some kind of a lack of role clarity. Or it might be, and I see this a lot in mediation, where people just have fundamentally different ways of working, you know, which is sort of personality related, you know. And it's the problem is, of course, they never talk about this. And so misunderstandings arise, and they never talk about those misunderstandings, and it just gets more and more ingrained. And in terms of the external drivers, I think here some of the conflict that arises is a result of people trying their best to articulate or give voice to the concerns of the very stakeholders they represent. Right? And so people aren't being a pain in the neck. People are actually working really hard to do justice to a particular community that they are the voice for in a particular community. And it can sometimes be mistaken for personality-based conflict, but it's not. It's just a function of people working hard to do what they think is right by whoever they represent. So those are, I think, the kind of the external drivers of conflict. And then I think there's kind of conflict that actually is quite beneficial, which is sort of conflict that we might have around ideas, you know, which is, of course, where the beauty of diversity comes in, you know. And diversity comes at a cost. It's more difficult to coordinate. It means that you surround yourself with people that will probably annoy you from time to time. But in diversity lies, I think, the opportunity for some really creative solutions to problems. And there's a lot of research behind the benefits of diversity, so I'm not saying anything groundbreaking. But that's a type of conflict that is actually quite useful to have, sort of cognitive conflict.
I think that for my kind of background, you're right, there's that individual personality element of conflict, or they all, I don't know if you've come across it, but certainly when I work with that type of conflict with leaders and psychiatrists, between psychiatrists, it's often a sense of loss. One of them feels that they're going to be losing something, maybe about their, around their professional identity or areas like that. So there's a kind of a fight mode they go into. But then I guess there's the other conflict, which is between teams. And I guess in the literature, we call that silos. And I've tried to reframe it, talking about positive silos, and actually trying to understand the conflict being based within culture. So it's actually a form of communication, trying to tell us something about what that team identity is about, comparing in relation to another team. And that's what needs to be worked with. So it's the fear of a team losing their sense of identity of being a group of engineers versus the marketing team telling them that they have to do a certain thing, or, you know, that kind of. So I'm quite interested in this idea of conflict being part of culture rather than outside culture. It's a form of communication. I don't know if that sits with you at all. Or...
It does. No, it resonates entirely. And I think it's a very powerful idea, right? You know, I think at the heart of a lot of conflict are issues of identity. And I think you're right in putting your finger on people's fear of losing part of what makes them who they are. And you see this in silos. I mean, the beauty of silos is that it gives people a very strong sense of belonging, you know, identity-wise. And it probably explains why silos persist, you know, despite many efforts of consultants and the like, you know, to try and change cultures. So, no, I think that's true. I think conflict can also be very healthy because it helps articulate identities and also helps articulate what matters most and why, because at least it prompts the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you're right. I think it's part of culture, and it can actually be quite a benign or quite helpful part of culture.
Yeah, and sometimes I guess it's often maybe it's the symptom of something as well. So it's usually the focus is on conflict, but actually it's been building up for, and we know this through escalation into conflict. But there's many different things that have created the conflict in the first place, and I read this beautiful thing when I did some research at the Wellcome Institute Library on the history of psychiatric hospitals many, many years ago. And in the 19th or 18th century, the head doctor, who was called a warden, wrote a letter or a manual for nurses saying the most evil thing you could do is gossip. Do never gossip. And that was all, if you think about it, it's all about conflict. It's all about silo. And trying to prevent that from happening, which is interesting. So, do you think then, looking and kind of drilling a little bit more into conflict and this idea of performance as well, and how conflict can, in a way, kind of hamper high performance and success? There's another story you talk about an army rowing team. And they weren't performing to a certain level, and maybe they didn't know why, but the leader or the coach got them to act out stuff. And I just think it's a fantastic story because it leads on to my next question. But could you tell us a bit about that, the army coaching or the army rowing team, and how they
So I'll do my best. It's quite a well-known story, written up, I think, as a Harvard case. But it takes place at or took place at West Point, which is where the American sort of army officers train. And you know, at West Point they have different sports, and they tend to be reasonably good at what they do. And so rowing is one of them. And Steph Brzezinski, I think his name was, he was the coach at the time, and he had a problem on his hand. And the problem was that the varsity team, which is the top team, the top crew, was beaten regularly by the junior varsity crew. And it shouldn't happen because on paper, the varsity crew should really be the much more powerful, the much faster crew. And I couldn't figure out what was happening until he got word that people in the varsity crew were very distrustful of each other in terms of whether everyone was really putting, in this case, his weight. And were really wanting to win, you know, whatever competition they were preparing for as badly as everyone else. Now, he knew that a heart-to-heart conversation wouldn't help. You know, that's not going to work. So he did something very risky, but I think ingenious. You know, he called the crew into the boathouse at West Point and said, listen, I've got in my pocket a stopwatch. I'm going to take it out and I'll let it run for 90 seconds. In that minute and a half, what I would like you to do is to pair up with someone else and to wrestle the other person to the ground. Now, several of the rowers said no, because we're preparing for a competition, which I think was about 4 or 5 days away, something like that. And if we wrestle and get injured, we can't row. And he replied saying, well, if you won't wrestle, then I will cut you from the crew today. And so he clicked his stopwatch and he said it started very awkward, as you might expect. And you know, they kind of got on with it, and he had people wrestle a few more times. It became quite a jovial affair. So once they got into it, they actually quite enjoyed it and became quite fun. And they had an outing. They did really, really well. And I think when finally the race was on, I don't think they won the race, but they came much higher in the rankings than anyone had expected at the time. And the reason I think the story is powerful is because he realized that what might be much more effective than a heart-to-heart conversation is actually giving people a visceral sense of how strong and how competitive the other crew members were. And what better than wrestling? It's perfect, right? Because wrestling gives you a really good first-hand feel of how powerful your teammates, in this case your crewmates, really are. It's wonderful. The problem, of course, is that in most workplaces we don't wrestle, right? So what's the equivalent of wrestling for most workplaces, right? So we need to be creative there.
But that's a good point, because I was thinking this idea, well, you are in an accountancy firm or a law firm and you break out on a Friday and all get into wrestling gear. That's not the fit. The thing about the rowing, they actually had to feel the physical bodies, because that was fundamentally what was making them successful or not successful. But if we take wrestling as a metaphor, which is fundamentally, I guess, a breaking out, a jolt away from what you're doing, how can that manifest itself within everyday teams? I mean, we have baking on a Friday or beers on a Thursday or whatever, right? But that doesn't seem to cut the mustard. Is it a away day? Do we go paintballing? Do we have to make rafts, all that tried and tested stuff? Or is there something else that's needed?
So I'm a little bit wary, I think, of the, you know, strapping yourself in a canoe with a commando type thing, you know, for a day. I think the pints in the pub afterwards, I think, are really good. the more healthy thing. Well, that's very, very gendered comment, right, to make. But, so here's what I think could work, but there's a risk involved. So when you have people in teams that do slightly different things as opposed to rowing, and by the way, in rowing, people don't always do the same thing. It just looks like they do. There's some subtle differences depending on where you sit in the boat. But that aside, you know, in a workplace where people do different things, what might actually help is to have people spend a day in the shoes of someone else, right? So, you know, take on someone else's job for a day and see how that feels, you know. There may be alternatives, but the point is to create an environment that fosters empathy, that helps people understand how challenging the work of someone else is. You know, it's you know, like this, you know, well-known story about people bearing a cross on their back, you know, and you think your own cross is heavy, but wait until you have someone else's cross on your back. You know, the only thing you want is to have your own cross back. and that can actually, I think, be quite helpful.
Yeah.
So I'm not a religious person, but I think it could be quite helpful.
Yeah. But that's interesting. So you're bringing, so the wrestle, going back to that metaphor, is actually a process of building empathy and understanding rather than it just being bonding as we've traditionally. And that's, it kind of goes back to what we spoke about in part one early on about actually becoming the ethnographer in a way for a bit, becoming the anthropologist, being able to experience the sensation of what someone else does, you know, in that world, which is quite powerful.
No, I think that's absolutely right. So I think, I mean, because you build empathy, much like wrestling, it helps you understand how very skilled that other person must be to be able to handle the kind of challenges that you, by maybe virtue of a job rotation program, you suddenly now understand in a way you never understood before. So I think it's very helpful. I think this is where the anthropologist's hat actually would fit very well in business, because you know, the reason you can do what you can do, or, you know, certainly the reason why you were so successful with your psychiatrist, sort of psychiatric ward studies, is because you leveraged what came maybe quite naturally to you, which is empathy. You know, it's humanity. Now, that can, of course, be weaponized, and to some extent it is, but it is what ethnographers do, it's what anthropologists do. And so I think, you know, again, you know, in business, I think that could go a very, very long way. You know, I mean, if you look at the mediation that I do, and you can speak for yourself, but that'd be interesting to hear your views, actually. You know, quite often, you know, the reason conflict arises in the workplace is because people don't have the grown-up conversation. People don't talk. You know, people, I think, are perpetually poor at having conversations that actually matter. And they know they should have. They just don't have. You know, and that's why things become hairy and scary. You know, I mediated a conflict recently between two people who had fallen out for an 8-year period. And one of them had gotten physically ill as a result. And at the end of the day, when you break it all down, it's due typically to some misunderstanding or a series of misunderstandings that aren't talked about. And because they aren't talked about, and because you and I can't live with a gap in a causal chain, we fill that gap with all sorts of bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us even more reason not to talk. You know, and at the end, it comes to a point whereby life becomes unbearable. So, you know, if only we were a bit better at having the grown-up conversation, I think we'd be miles ahead.
This is a very interesting point, because my experience dealing with conflict in the workplace is exactly that, or mediation when it comes to that kind of personalized. And the first thing you do is create your tribe or your army behind you. So you're desperate to get as many people behind you to back you. So you have the only truth, but the other person is probably doing exactly the same thing. So almost working with a conflict, you have to deconstruct the fact that there are two truths here, and both are grounded in cement in what their truths are. Now have you experienced that as well? That kind of rallying cry that people do talk, but they're talking in the wrong direction.
Oh, completely. And in fact, you know, you see examples of this on a larger canvas around Brexit, you know, around Trump. The world divides, right, and gets entrenched.
That's a really good point. And it's almost like that, bringing that in, Brexit or Trump, we're actually seeing a macrocosm, macro level of what we experience in workplace culture or conflict. You know, which is more kind of individual or between groups, but it becomes black and white, bad. You know, it's binary oppositions, and it's something about us as the mediators or the coaches being able to work with it that we have to unpack that binary part. You recently gave a talk. It's online as well. I'll put it in the show notes. On the Cambridge Judge, one of the webinars, which was a fascinating talk you gave, and very much situated where we are now in lockdown. And we've been talking about high-performing teams, team culture. We've been talking about conflict in teams. And these are all totally relevant when a lot of us around the world are sitting at home, homeschooling, but also working and doing multiple things. And your talk is called How to Have Courageous Conversations in Lockdown. And what I found really helpful about that talk were that you set out six kind of themes or principles that people need to work through. And I'm not really needing, you know, you don't have to kind of go, okay, principle one, but just to talk through that, because you've touched a bit about the conversation, but this word courageous conversations, and you know, there's something about honesty there, but it's in this time of lockdown. And when we talk about lockdown, I certainly have this feeling of physically our body is locked down as well. You know, our vocal cords are locked down, right? So could you talk through a bit about what does courageous conversations in lockdown mean?
Yeah, no, thank you. And what you just said, I think the way you framed it resonates for sure, right? I think courageous conversations are conversations that are uncomfortable to have, which is why they require a bit of courage on our part. And I won't talk you through the 6 points, but what I thought I might do is just talk you through kind of three broader areas, you know, and in so doing, we'll kind of capture, I think, what these 6 points are mostly about. And so let me say a little bit about how we might go about preventing those conversations, not just in lockdown, but including lockdown. Something around how to prepare for them, should we have to have them. And finally, how you then handle yourself in the conversation. So these are, if that's okay with you, just these three bits.
Of course, perfect.
So in terms of preparation, you know, what I think is really helpful for workplaces, and this can be done on Zoom, it can be done face-to-face, is to have a contracted conversation. And there's some very nice work done by a couple of colleagues at IMD around this, whereby you can have a series of conversations around questions, and the questions always start the same way in your world. It's not in your culture. It's not in your, you know, necessarily in your workplace. It's in your world. So, for example, in your world, how you know, what makes for a good first impression? You know, and you all talk to this, and it's interesting what people come up with, because you know your first impressions may not be mine. You know, in your world, what's more important, harmony or directness? In your world, can I give you feedback? You know, and if so, how would you like to receive it? In your world, how would I know that you're annoyed with me? You know? So these questions can be really helpful, because what they help do is to prevent us from making assumptions that aren't warranted, but we make them because we have to make them. So instead of making an assumption about what makes for a good first impression, or to make assumptions about how you'd like to receive feedback, I'm going to be a grown-up, and I'm going to ask you about this. So that's very helpful. I think number two, and this is particularly true for Zoom, I think, give people the benefit of doubt, right? Mm-hmm. So because communication is imperfect, you know, something might be said that you can't fix in the moment because the Zoom call has ended. You can't walk to someone's desk and have that little chat. I think it's really, really important to remember that most people, for most of the time, actually try really, really hard to do the right thing. And I'm almost certain that's true.
Mm-hmm.
It may not look like it. But often they are, you know. And so giving people the benefit of doubt, I think, is really important. Preventing long silences, I think, on email is really important. So if I send you an email and I get no response, well, what does it mean? Well, it might mean that you're not in the office and you just forgot to turn on that automatic reply system. Yeah? It might be that you saw my email come in, you know, and you know it's really important, but you just don't have time for it now. So what you do, because it's important, you can save it till tonight or tomorrow. Or the end of the week, or it might be that you saw my email, you read my email, you don't know what to say. It might be you saw my email, you read my email, you didn't think a response was required. The problem is, I don't know. And because you can't live with these gaps in the causal chain, I'm going to fill that gap, often with it's pretty negative stuff, right? I think also in Zoom, it's really important, and I think you alluded to this, it's to provide a bit of context around your life. What's front of mind for you? What's going on right now? You know, on Zoom, you know, you don't get the same visual cues that you might otherwise have. And so it's hard to tell sometimes what space people are in, you know, and the different ways of doing this, you know, you could use a temperature chart, you know, where are you? Are you cold? Are you hot? And just tell me why. It doesn't matter where you position yourself. Just tell me what it means for you, for example. You know, what color are you? It's a silly question, but are you blue or red or purple? What are you? And you might say, well, I'm green. You know, that's fine. What does that mean? It's all about the second question. What does it mean?
Yeah.
So that, I think, in terms of preventing the conversation, I think in terms of how to prepare for it, so because they're uncomfortable, I think preparation is really important. I think the first thing we need to do is to ask ourselves how we want to feel going into the conversation. Okay. And I think that's important generally, because the calmer we are, the more composed we are, the more likely the other people will judge us as being intelligent or capable. You know, there's some interesting research behind this, and it doesn't cost very much. And it will work for us. I think that's number one. I think number two, to ask ourselves what we would ideally want to walk away with. So at the end of this, it's going to be difficult, but I'm going to do the grown-up thing and have the conversation. And what I would like to walk away with is X. You know, it may not be perfect, but it's pretty decent. And the reason that's important is because most conversations will feel worse before they start feeling better. And I don't know about your experience in mediating, but quite often, you know, when you have these mediations, there's a point where it dips, you know. And I think what sometimes really helps when things get difficult and you have to listen to things that are just difficult to listen to, it just helps to keep front of mind why you're here. So finally, I think in terms of how you handle the conversation, I think it's really helpful to remember that what you're having is not one conversation. What you're having are at least five conversations. So the first conversation is the future conversation. So at the end of the day, what would each of us be happy if it's two people, each of us be happy to walk away with? And sometimes it helps to articulate at the front. And what you'll find often is that people very much want the same thing, which is to kind of get on with their life and their work. The second conversation is sort of the stepping back, so what really happened conversation. You know, there's a quite a factual conversation, just to see if you both have a similar reading of the facts of the case. And then the third conversation is the most difficult. It is the feelings conversation. You know, it's tough, but you must have it. You know, it's you know, you're asking people now to talk not about what happened, but about the impact, you know, that whatever happened had on them, on their health and their well-being. And that gets very painful, because when you ask people to open up and tell you how badly they feel about what was said to them or done to them by you, you know, the temptation is to interrupt, you know, and say, well, I didn't mean to. And one of the ground rules is, well, you know, there will only be one voice in the room at any one time. You'll get your chances. So you have to take that in. You have to absorb the pain of someone else. The reason it's critical, I think, is because of something that the late Willie Brown, who's the master of my Cambridge College, a well-known economist and wonderful man, what really Rounds told me, he said, when people are angry with you, there is no point reasoning with people.
Mm-hmm.
All you need to do, he said, is to let them talk themselves empty. And at some point, they will be empty. You know, and when they're empty, that is when your work can begin, not before it. I think that is so true. That is so true. You know? And then the other two conversations, there's, of course, the solutions conversation, where you both sit and say, okay, well, what could we do? You know, and finally, the commitment one. And the commitment ones, I think, is an interesting one, because it's not just about me saying, okay, here's what I promise to do differently in the future, because I know it's not working for us. But it's also about calling in a favor and saying, I can't do this by myself. I need you to do something for me to help me out.
Hmm.
Next time this happens, please not do, or please do the following. It's not guaranteed to work, but I think by and large, it's not a bad way of structuring.
How does that, because you can imagine just how helpful that is, especially in this kind of working from home, dense environment so many people are experiencing, and to be able to have those conversations. But what it got me thinking about a little bit was hierarchy. So if I was the leader of a team, maybe I was comfortable approaching you in my team and saying, hey, Mark, look, we need to have it'd be great to have a conversation with you. But if it's the other way around, and you've got hierarchy, so someone kind of lower in the pecking order in the team, having that confidence to put their head above the water and approach a conversation, I can imagine that's going to cause some problems, or if anything, just the person resorts or kind of retreats back.
I'm sure that's true, and it's something that's very difficult to overcome, but put yourself in the shoes of whoever's in charge, right? You know, many people that are in very senior positions, will own up to the fact that their lives can be quite lonely lives, you know, because at the end of the day, you become quite isolated, even if you hold the reins, so to speak. And so wouldn't you want people to talk to you? Wouldn't you want people to tell you what it would probably be good for you to know? Whether that means telling you about some idiosyncrasies that they've noticed about a client.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, yeah.
Because they probably are closer to the client than you are, or whether it's something to do with a particular decision or a particular behavior that just doesn't help you get the best out of the people you work with. I mean, wouldn't you want to know? And therefore, I think it's really critical when you're in charge to create an environment that feels so safe psychologically that it's a little bit more likely. You know, people will, you know, can do the adult thing and say, you know, I know this is uncomfortable. I hope you're taken the right way. you know, but there's something I'd love to tell you. Because, you know what, I've been thinking about this several days, and you know what, if I were in your shoes, I would like to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you okay with me telling you, you know? And I may not get it right, and it may not come out right.
Do you think it's the leader that needs to be able to facilitate that safe environment, where people then are encouraged to have conversations that they're allowed to, rather than it just being an individual act that we know that we... It's almost like you want to part of KPIs, right? That people... When I was in the psychiatric hospital, every 2 weeks you used to have a psychologist coming down, and we'd have an hour and a half as a group, as the team, with the psychologist. And that might be talking about patients and how hard it is for us. But soon it became about how we had issues with each other in the team. And it became very fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So again, talk about an ultra safe space. You know, it was ritualized. It was very formulaic. But I'm just wondering if, especially with lockdown, is there something about the need for some form of ritualized safe space where those conversations take place, or should it be more fluid?
I think it might have to start with something that is staged, you know, we call it ritualized. And I think it's only when people recognize the power of having the grown-up conversation that hopefully it will become more culturally acceptable, whereby, you know, it becomes just a little bit easier to say, hey, you know, can I give you a bit of feedback and ask for some feedback? You know, but it may have to start in a slightly more formulaic
mm-hmm.
way. You know, in Zoom, it's not impossible to do. It's not the same thing, but it is what we have. So we have to make the best of what we have. I mean, it's interesting because I do mediations now on Zoom, and I worried about it because I wasn't sure if it would work. But actually, it does seem to kind of work, because there is also a benefit of people being in their own comfortable spaces, safe spaces at home, knowing that, you know, if anything happens that's really, really bad, they can just turn off the computer.
Yeah.
As opposed to having to walk out of a room and out of a building and into a car or the...
They need a physical space, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So... You know, and there's something about that actually is or can be very, very helpful, you know, because you've got your home comforts, your own coffee cup, you know, favorite coffee cup, and your own computer and your own books around you, paperwork, and you're in control in a way that you're not necessarily in control in a physical room.
That's a really important point. I find a similar thing by coaching through Zoom or online, where the coachee actually realizes, or no, they don't realize, they are there because either they need to be there or they want to be there. So they need coaching, and they've entered into that contract, and they're totally... So the fact that it isn't ideal, that we can't do some of the exercises that you can do as a coach that uses the physical body, there's still enough there because there is a need, commitment, and focus, which I think if you've got that... Then you can work with it. Then you can work with the technologies around you. Mark, listen, I'm totally aware of time. I want to thank you so much. We've been speaking for just over an hour, and I think we could have carried on and on and on, but which means we're going to have more conversations at a later date. My final question, though, and I give this to all my guests, I'm going to hand you over the Symbolic Anthropologist's notebook to take away and study any institutional business for 1 year. Where are you going to take that anthropologist's notebook?
So, you know what? I knew this question was coming, and it's the hardest question, I think, for me to try and answer, right? Part of me thinks that it almost doesn't matter where you put me, because I think there are nice, interesting stories to be explored wherever you are, you know? So long as you spent enough time, I think, you know, but part of me, of course, wants to do what I've done for the last 15 years, which is to look at relatively extreme environments, you know, where people try and make for a meaningful life for themselves in maybe circumstances that aren't ideal or are very different from our own. You know, and there may be several candidates for where that could be, you know. And I've been racking my brain over what I might want to do next, but you know, I could probably do anything, you know, and I would find it interesting. But I think I would like to look at the extremities of society,
mm-hmm.
where people might live quite isolated lives, and just to see, you know, what makes for a meaningful existence for them, you know.
Right.
So I leave it deliberately quite ambiguous, but it's just such a tough question.
Yeah.
Quite often we can't study what we want to study because we can't get in, you know.
That's very interesting. And that's the first time I think someone said to me, it's a very hard question, and which is very enlightening for me, because I think it's just like a nice way to end them. But that actually is a very good point. And I think what's very strong about your point is that actually I could have taken that notebook anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the core component of ethnography, is that the ethnographer's eye and ears as listening should be able to create meaning from whatever they're studying. They should be, in a way, being parachuted into wherever, using that metaphor. Mark, thank you so much for being on the Decoding Culture podcast, and I hope we're going to get to speak again.
You're very welcome. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that this episode on conflict has helped you think about your own working life, how it exists now, and what it might look and feel like when the pandemic is less obtrusive. The challenge will be to understand where conflict will be visible and invisible. Empathy in its true sense will be key. If you're interested in organizational culture and how to decode it, I have just started running my training course in partnership with Epic called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact. I will put details of the course content in the show notes, but keep your eyes open to when the course will be run again. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed, and please feel free to give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business, and anthropology, you can also sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link is also in the show notes. See you next time.